The Bible stores a lot of its glory in jars of clay. By which I mean the Bible is full from beginning to end of sentences that the first time you read them sound rather ho-hum and ordinary, but are actually packed with fantastic, even outrageous truth. And the book that we're preaching through right now, the book of Esther, ends with a sentence like that. And so this morning I want to begin at the end and then do the rest of the sermon by asking the question, how do we get here? So how did we get to Esther chapter 10, verse 3, which reads, For Mordecai the Jew was second in rank to King Ahasuerus. And he was great among the Jews and popular with the multitude of his brothers, for he sought the welfare of his people and spoke peace to his people. That sentence is remarkable. We can start at the beginning. For Mordecai the Jew was second in rank to King Ahasuerus. In the Persian Empire, Mordecai the Jew was a member of a religious and ethnic minority and one who had just finished leading a resistance movement against high government. This is roughly the equivalent of if someone like Crazy Horse or Sitting Bull or Chief Joseph, one of the Native American chieftains of the 19th century who led resistance movements against the United States Army, if they had finished those resistance movements and then immediately been elected president. That's roughly what we're talking about here. But even more important than that Mordecai is ruling is how he rules. The sentence ends, for he sought the welfare of his people and spoke peace to his people. Would that it were normal for us to be ruled like that. Wouldn't it be wonderful if you filled out your ballot, as I did last night, and you were flipping through that pamphlet they send you, and you were just overwhelmed with having to choose between so many candidates who want to do nothing except seek the welfare of the people? If we just had nothing to choose from but that, can we get some Mordecais in the house? In this world where peace is so elusive, life can be so dark and so complicated, how do we get people who just seek peace? And look, I don't want to oversell it. It does not say that Mordecai achieved peace. But it does say that his rule was characterized by seeking and speaking peace. How do we get to that? Well, it turns out that in Mordecai's case, it isn't something terribly complex or spectacular. In the story leading up to this point, Mordecai is not particularly brilliant or insightful. Mordecai is not a genius. He's not a once-in-a-generation talent. Instead, Mordecai is nothing more, but also nothing less than a man of integrity. What gets Mordecai from where he starts the story to where he ends it is simple integrity. Now, that's combined with a healthy dose of divine providence, and we're going to, Lord willing, get to that later in the series. But in terms of the man, Mordecai, what characterizes him is not complexity, but simplicity. Not that he's brilliant, but that he can make the right basic choice. And there are five scenes in which Mordecai is prominently involved in the story that I want to go through and see what's going on with Mordecai, what causes him to end up at chapter 10, verse 3, second in rank to the king and seeking the welfare of his people. And through those scenes, my hope is that we will see that peace is actually a much simpler thing than we realize. Not easier. I'm not saying that peace is easy, but that it is simple. All right, so we're going to look at the first three scenes and unpack those a little bit and then get to the fourth and the fifth one. So we first meet Mordecai. The first scene is in chapter 2 of Esther. And we meet him The first time we see him doing anything is in chapter 2, verse 7, which says, Mordecai was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther, the daughter of his uncle, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman had a beautiful figure and was lovely to look at, and when her father and her mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So this is pretty straightforward. Mordecai has a younger cousin, Esther, whose parents die somehow, tragically, when she's still pretty young, and he takes her in. This is an absolute minefield for Mordecai. It says that Esther is a young woman, which means early in her adolescence, round about 13 years old. She, in addition to just being a 13-year-old, has just gone through an unspeakable tragedy. How easy for Mordecai to say, I am not up to this. I am not the best place for Esther. What do I know about raising teenage girls? She needs a maternal presence, and I am unmarried. Can anybody else take this on? Surely no one would have expected Mordecai to take Esther in. No one would have scolded him if he didn't. I mean, if anything, he's going to be scolded for doing it, right? The one thing we know about Esther at this point is that she had a beautiful figure and was lovely to look at. And what we know about Mordecai is that he's a fairly young guy, maybe my age, and he's single. And he is now proposing to live with this beautiful teenage girl. You can picture the neighborhood gossip, can you not? This is a minefield for Mordecai. He has reasons upon reasons not to do this. And yet, for Mordecai, the decision is a straightforward and simple one. Esther needs a home. I will give it to her. Esther needs a family. I will be her family. He takes what could be considered an incredibly complex and difficult moral question and makes it simple. That's the first thing that we see Mordecai doing. The next scene, the second scene, is just later in chapter 2. Some things have happened in the meantime. Esther has actually become queen of Persia, strangely enough. And Mordecai is some sort of kind of middle management person in the Persian government. He's around the citadel, around the palace, but he doesn't have much authority. And so let's pick it up in chapter 2, verse 21. In those days, as Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigtan and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold, became angry and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. There are two of Mordecai's roughly peers, two of the other king's servants, are trying to kill the king. And this came to the knowledge of Mordecai, and he told it to Queen Esther, and Esther told the king in the name of Mordecai. When the affair was investigated and found to be so, both men were hanged on the gallows, and it was recorded in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. So Mordecai, he finds out that a couple of his coworkers don't like the boss very much. I'm sure none of you have ever experienced that before. They're about to act on it. They're going to do something. They're going to take matters into their own hands. And Mordecai is then faced with a dilemma. He can be that guy, the one who rats out his peers to the people above, or he can let things go. He doesn't have to do anything active here, right? He can just act like he didn't hear anything and let things take their course. It's not like he's in the Secret Service, sworn to protect the king. And it's not like he's the one who's going to be acting, right? It's going to cost him if he speaks up. He's going to pay for it. And more than that, King Ahasuerus is a terrible king. He's awful. He has already done heinous stuff. He's going to do more heinous stuff. He is no friend of the Jews, as he will prove just in the next chapter. Mordecai can very easily say, "What has this king ever done for me? What do I care who sits on the throne? Let the Persians sort it out themselves." He can rationalize doing just about anything here, and yet, for Mordecai, again, the choice is simple. Tell the truth. Stop what might be a murder. Serve the country in which God has placed him. Again, Mordecai takes something that we could make complex and sees it as simple. This effort for peace that Mordecai makes is actually a simple thing. The third scene, not at all coincidentally, comes immediately after the second one. At the beginning of chapter 3, the third scene. After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the Agagite. That's supposed to startle you, right? Mordecai just did a great service to the king. You would expect Mordecai's name to be there. But the king promoted Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, and advanced him and set his throne above all the officials who were with him. And all the king's servants who were at the gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage. Then the king's servants who were at the king's gate said to Mordecai, "Why do you transgress the king's command?" And when they spoke to him day after day, and he would not listen to him, they told Haman in order to see whether Mordecai's words would stand. For he had told them that he was a Jew. So Mordecai, he's just proved himself a company man, right? He's put his neck on the line for the sake of protecting the king. And now this order comes down from the king. Haman is going to be in charge, and I want everybody to bow down to Haman and pay homage. Now, one of the virtuous things about our country, the time and place in which we live, is that bowing down to other human beings has sort of gone out of style. It's not a thing that we do as Americans. But it was a completely normal thing in ancient Persia. Nobody would have seen this as a big deal, and so nobody refused to do it, except Mordecai. Right? He's already lost all his friends among his peers by showing himself to be loyal to the king, and now he's rebelling against the king. He's refusing to obey a direct order. He's putting himself in a lot of trouble. How easy it would be to say, hey, look, this isn't a big deal, just go with it. It's just putting your knee on the ground for a few seconds. And if you're here and you're serving and you're hoping to do some good over the course of your life, then you better not rebel, because you will end up dead. He very nearly does end up dead. He's giving up a lifetime of potential good deeds. How many more Esthers could he take in? How many more plots could he foil if he just didn't insist on this? But for Mordecai, the choice is simple. You shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve. I bow down to the King of Kings and nobody else. Once again, Mordecai takes a dilemma that might flummox us, that might tie us up in knots, and sees it as simple and acts simply. All three, these are the first three scenes in which Mordecai appears in the story, all have this same tenor of there's a moral quandary put in front of Mordecai that could just cause his mind to explode. And yet without any fanfare or difficulty, Mordecai chooses what is right. That's what marks him. The key to his integrity is actually his simplicity. James, in the New Testament, in chapter 3 of his letter, he says that the wisdom that comes from above is first of all pure. That wisdom is first of all pure. If something is pure, then it's just itself, right? Pure water contains only H2O, no particulates, no chlorine to get rid of the germs, no germs. It's just the one thing. And the wisdom of Mordecai is that way. In the midst of 1,000 questions he could be asking, he manages to consistently ask just one question: what is right right now? What would God have of me in such a time and place as this? That's all Mordecai concerns himself with. Contrast that with our view of wisdom. If you've seen or read The Lord of the Rings, the wise man in The Lord of the Rings is Gandalf, and he says something that's true, but it also betrays our view of wisdom. He says, even the very wise cannot see all ends. Which is right, but it implies that wisdom consists in seeing as many ends as possible. Being able to gaze into the future and determine all the consequences of our actions. We define wisdom in terms of being able to see all sides of the story, weigh up all the options, make a very thorough pro-con list. We would almost define wisdom as the ability to doubt well. Right? If a person is always saying, yes, I see your point, but consider this as well, we tend to assume that is wise. Mordecai has a different and simpler kind of wisdom. And the difference is that Mordecai's wisdom is not encumbered with an inflated sense of responsibility, with the idea that he should be able to see the future or control the outcome. Consider the two situations that Mordecai gets himself into. One is about taking into his home and into his care a difficult person, right? And we make that complex because we want to be able to see, can I handle it? Is this going to work out well in the end? The nation of Iceland has recently all but eliminated Down syndrome. And that's been celebrated as a victory for public health because there are now virtually no children in Iceland with Down syndrome. But what's really happening is that we are testing and discovering in the womb that these children have Down syndrome, and seeing all ends, taking responsibility for the outcome, we decide this is not worth it. There will be more suffering than joy for this child and or for their parents, and so we take care of it in wisdom. That's not the way Mordecai would see it. Here is a child. What would God have of me? God would have me love and care for the child. I'm not responsible for figuring out what that child's life might be like in 20 years. I'm responsible for loving them today. Or take the dilemma with the assassination plot. One of the sort of famous moral quandaries, hypothetical situations that we tend to ask is, what if you, knowing what you know now, could go back to Austria in the 1920s? And you found yourself in a room. It's just you and Mr. Hitler and a pistol in your hand. And the question is supposed to be this, like, whoa, is murder ever okay? Let me think about it. But the seduction of the question is, what if you knew? What if you could control events? What if you could determine the future? What if you could really be wise? You see the difference between that and Mordecai's wisdom, which does not presume to know the future or be able to control events, but just says, I know about an evil thing that might happen, and I might be able to stop it. I need to try and stop it. It's a much simpler, purer kind of thing. What if the moral dilemmas that you face, the quandaries that you can't figure out, are not necessarily easy, but actually much simpler than you realize? What if peace really is a simple thing? And look, we're not talking about every possible dilemma, right? Some of you right now, and all of us at certain points, face questions of wisdom that don't kind of fall on this axis. They're more of the shall I turn left or shall I turn right, as opposed to what is wrong and what is right. You know, which school should I go to? Should I move? Should I retire? And those aren't questions that we can address through Mordecai because he doesn't face those kind of questions. But the wrong or right questions, I don't know what the right thing to do here is, those are questions that Mordecai faces. And it turns out that for him, and I would argue for us too, they are simpler than we realize. Maybe they have to do with taking someone into care. You know, it could be a child, or it could be an elder. Right? Maybe they have to do with, how am I supposed to interact with the political realities of today? Or it could be other things. How do I handle this persistent conflict that happens again and again and again? How do I interact with my neighbors, the people in my apartment building or my dorm or on my street? And I suggest to you that while answering these questions is not easy, it is often very simple. That we need not be hypnotized by complexity, fooled into believing that we have responsibility for all the outcomes, and instead ask the pure wisdom from above question, what is right, right now? What would God have me do in such a time and place as this? Now that can sound really good, but it is obviously easier said than done. Right. So if Mordecai is simple, and we are called to be as simple as he is and pursue peace in the way that he does, how do we actually do that? How do we tune out all the other questions and just focus on what is right right now? Can I get some of those noise-canceling headphones? And now I want to turn to the fourth and fifth scenes in which we see Mordecai. I believe the answer is here for us. These are both complicated scenes, and I just want to focus on how Mordecai responds to something. So I'm going to kind of blaze through the context. The fourth scene that we're looking at here is in chapter 4. It's at the end of chapter 4. What's going on here is that Haman, the guy who the king promoted, has decided that he needs to kill all the Jews because Mordecai wouldn't bow down. And Mordecai's found out about it, and he's talked to Queen Esther and said, you need to go to the king and do something about that. And then Esther has said, you realize that if I do that, I'm probably going to die because I'm going into the king's presence without his permission. And Mordecai has said, I do realize that. God is going to save his people, and he is inviting you to participate. And Esther hears Mordecai's counsel. She accepts it, and then this is how she responds. So I'm picking it up in chapter 4, verse 15. Then Esther told the servants, to reply to Mordecai, go, gather all the Jews to be found in Susa and hold a fast on my behalf and do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my young women will also fast as you do. Then I will go to the king, though it is against the law, and if I perish, I perish. Mordecai then went away and did everything as Esther had ordered him. In order to understand the simple magnitude of what Mordecai does there in verse 17, you need to know two things. The first is that ancient Persia, where the story is set, was an honor-shame society, which means that looking bad publicly was worse than death. It was like the internet. The second thing you need to know is that ancient Persia was a patriarchal society, which means that men did not ever, ever, ever take orders from women. To do so would be shameful. It would be worse than death. And what we have here is Esther issuing an order to Mordecai. Mordecai then went away and did everything as Esther had ordered him. And she issues it publicly. Now, she has no choice about that. There's no malice. Given the situation, she has to send it as a message entrusted to other people. But that word is going to get out. Mordecai is doing a woman's bidding. Now, even today, if this scene plays out in a sports bar, it's shameful. If I'm in there hanging out with my guys on Friday night and Vanessa comes in and says, hey, you promised to do the dishes, come with me. And I leave with her, I will be ashamed. Now, I should just be ashamed for not keeping my promises, but that's not really why I'll be ashamed. How much worse back there and back then? And yet Mordecai does it. Again, no fanfare. Mordecai then went away and did everything as Esther had ordered him. And this isn't a situation where he's, you know, what we would kind of naturally interpret that as is, oh, he's spineless, right? The orders he's given include gathering all the Jews in the city and getting them to fast for 3 days, organizing an entire people and then convincing them not to eat or drink from Tuesday to Friday. That is not the behavior of a spineless man. The only way to interpret this is that Mordecai simply was not affected by being publicly humiliated. He didn't care. It did not bother him. That's what's going on in the fourth scene. The fifth scene is a little while later in chapter 6. Haman, remember, has been trying to get Mordecai killed for a while now. And then through a series of circumstances that prove God has a sense of humor, instead of getting to lift Mordecai up on the gallows for which he has built so that he can hang Mordecai, instead Haman is forced to set Mordecai upon the king's horse and dress him in the king's robe and parade him around the city telling everybody how wonderful Mordecai is. So that's the context for this one. Chapter 6, verse 11. So Haman took the robes and the horse, the royal robes and the royal horse, and he dressed Mordecai and led him through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. Then Mordecai returned to the king's gate. This is Mordecai's moment. This is his victory. This is his 15 minutes of fame. That he woke up in the morning, a man with a death sentence, just waiting for the order to come down for him to be hanged. And then his very enemy is dressing him and setting him on high and carrying him around, telling everybody about how amazing he is. And Mordecai's response, he gets off the horse and he goes and sits back down where he was before he got on the horse. There's no victory lap here. He doesn't run to tell his friends. He doesn't gloat to Haman, right? He doesn't put it up on social media, you know, hashtag blessed, hashtag God is so good, hashtag PS, I really just want you to look at me and be impressed. He goes and he sits back down. He is no more affected by public exaltation than he is by public humiliation. He doesn't care. It does not affect him. The two of these scenes together show Mordecai as a person freed from ego. He does not care if you think highly of him. He does not care if you think poorly of him. Because those kinds of questions don't apply at all to, God, help me understand what is right right now. What would you have me do at such a time as this? Mordecai is not concerned with how things will affect him, with whether or not things will work out for him, with whether or not he can pay the consequences of what God is asking him to do. His mind and heart are not shaped by those fears. And because of that lack of ego, because of that self-forgetfulness, he is able to practice the pure wisdom that comes from above. When the questions of ego aren't causing ripples on the surface of his soul is still and quiet and peaceful enough to reflect the face of God shining down upon it. That's what's going on with Mordecai. He is not encumbered by an inflated sense of self that says, I'm responsible for figuring everything out and anticipating everything and planning for everything. And he's not encumbered by an inflated sense of self that says, hey, I've got to protect me. I've got to constantly be figuring out what I'm capable of and what I can do. No, Mordecai is just completely determined by doing what is right. Turn back to chapter 4, just before the verses we read. This is the only time that we get Mordecai's precise words in the book of Esther. In chapter 4, verses 13 and 14, he's trying to convince Esther to risk her life, to do the simple, pure wisdom from above thing. Then Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, "Do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this." You see what the foundation of Mordecai's argument is. God's got this. And the only thing you need to be afraid of is missing out on participating in God's plan. That's Mordecai's belief. The Lord is near to the righteous and he hears their cry. He loves the brokenhearted and saves the crushed in spirit. Many may be the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivers him out of them all. And if that's true, then I'm not responsible for the future. God is. And I don't need to be focused on me. I can be focused on him. And then peace becomes a simple thing. If you've got your Bible, turn over to the letter of James that I quoted earlier. And I'm looking at chapter 3, verses 17 and 18. But the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, open to reason, full of mercy and good fruits, impartial and sincere. And a harvest of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. James's argument in his letter is the argument that Mordecai lived, beginning with purity, beginning with simplicity, focusing on the most important question and not getting distracted by ego is what leads to peace. Peace really is a simple thing. The wisdom from above is first pure, and then it is peaceable. Hope for ourselves and for our world does not lie in complexity, but in simplicity. The way of peace will not be the way of ever more nuanced research and policies. The way of peace will be the way of a simple people with simple faith, who are continually asking of God, what is right now? I know you were at work. I know you were on the move. How do I participate with you? By a people like that, a harvest of righteousness will be sown in peace. There's a story that's still told in Denmark from World War II. It's about their king at the time, King Christian. King Christian was there when Denmark was very quickly and thoroughly occupied by Germany. He was there when the order came down that all the Danish Jews needed to start wearing a yellow star on their arm. And King Christian loved his people. He loved the Jewish people and in one sense was faced with an incredibly complex question. How do you protect your people when you're not really ruling them anymore? How do you strike the balance between resisting an evil world and yet not provoking it and causing undue destruction? How do you weigh how much to care for and protect the Jews in your country versus all the people? Because if you rise up against this, then it won't be just the Jews, but all the people who were suffer. How easy for King Christian to get obsessed with an inflated sense of responsibility and start trying to figure out all the potential outcomes. The story goes that he didn't do that, that for him it was simpler. Stand with the oppressed. And so he called in his tailor in the middle of the night, and he had his tailor work on his jacket, and the next morning he went out amongst his people with a yellow star on his arm, risking his own life, risking his position as a barrier between the Nazis and his citizens. But his people got the hint, and before long, every Dane, Jewish or not, was wearing a yellow star on their arms. They were all standing with the oppressed. And the Nazis didn't know whom they were supposed to be bullying and beating up. A harvest of righteousness was sown in peace by those who make peace. Look, Mordecai was a man of peace. So was King Christian. So have many other men and women been throughout history. So I hope we will grow into being. But our hope is not in them. And our hope is not in us. Mordecai, he sought the welfare of his people and he spoke peace to his people, but he never achieved peace. The Jews never really knew peace in ancient Persia. King Christian sought the welfare of his people. He spoke peace to his people, but Denmark did not know peace under his reign. They were occupied. Our hope for peace is not in getting enough Mordecais elected to the Senate or the White House or the school board or the elder board. And our hope for peace in this world is not in us. As much as we may strive to be people of peace, to take our egos that have seemed so essential to us and just punt them off a cliff, never to be seen again, as much as we may strive for the pure wisdom from above, we know that we're going to fail. That selfishness is going to creep back in, that our egos will take back over and tear us out of the good soil of self-forgetfulness and leave us to wither. Hope for peace is not in us. Our hope for peace is simpler than that. Our hope for peace is that a harvest of righteousness was sown in peace by the one who made peace. Our hope for peace is that though we dwell in a land of deep darkness, of confusion and complexity, on us a light has shone. That we live in a land of deep darkness, the light of the peace of Jesus, the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ shines on us. Our hope is that to us a child was born, that to us a son was given, and the government of the world shall not be upon our shoulders, but upon his. And he shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Everlasting Father, Mighty God, Prince of Peace. And that the increase of his government and of peace there will be no end. Our hope is that Jesus really is King, who over all things so wondrously reigneth, that he really was God made flesh, that he really did come to earth and die in our place for our sins, that there might be peace between us and God, that he really did rise from the grave and break down the barriers of hostility, that he really is right at this moment in heaven praying for you, that you might be a person of peace, that he will come again to judge the living and the dead. And under him there will be peace without end. Our hope is in Jesus. That the way of peace is the way of simple faith in him. Let's pray. Jesus, we need you. Every hour we need you. We need your peace. We are tied up in knots, hypnotized by complexity, confused, seeing ourselves as too big and too small at the same time. Teach us to trust in you. Give us the pure wisdom that you brought down from above when you came to earth. Give us faith and help us to follow you. Make us a people who seek peace. A people who know the peace you promised us. Amen.